Welcome to the Ardella Training Podcast, where we bridge the gaps between strength, performance, and injury prevention. My name is Scott Ardella, and welcome to episode number 212. This week, my guest is Brett Bartholomew, who is a top strength coach and author of an amazing new book that I am currently reading titled Conscious Coaching. This is a book for all coaches, trainers, and communicators, a book for teachers. And this is a very important topic for the podcast. And this interview is outstanding, rapid fire and fast paced with great, great content. Now, before we get into the show, I have had some excellent feedback about last week's unique interview with Fabio Zonin and Paulo Evangelista. Paulo, as you know, if you heard last week's show, is the author of a tremendous book titled DCSS, Power Mechanics for Power Lifters. A couple of quick things. This book is currently not available, as I found out. It is not available on Amazon right now. But we are certainly hoping, or Paulo is certainly hoping, to make this book available here in the United States in an English version. I hope that this can happen because this book looks absolutely incredible. So I will certainly provide any future updates about that here on the show. So stay tuned for that. I don't think that will be anytime soon, but if it does happen, I will certainly let you know here on the show. Also, if you're not a part of the Ardella Training community, make sure you go to ardellatraining.com/join, where you can get a couple of great free resources right now and also stay up to date with all the latest things and future things that are happening here on the Ardella Training podcast. And also, to quickly find this episode online, you'll find it at ardellatraining.com/RT212. Again, that is ardellatraining.com/RT212. And that will have all the links and resources that we discuss here in this episode today. So let's get into this important episode. I'm really excited and honored to have Brett join the show to discuss so many things about the art of coaching and discuss his amazing work and what he is doing in the industry. I'm really, really excited about this and excited to share this with you. We literally just did this interview and I was able to turn around this episode, this interview very quickly and get it out there to you. And at the end of the session, he even talks about how he trains and when he trains as a very busy strength and conditioning coach. So just great stuff all the way through this one. I know you're going to enjoy it. So let's jump into it. And then I will circle back with you at the end of the interview. Enjoy the show, guys. All right, guys. I'm very excited to have the author of Conscious Coaching, Coach Brett Bartholomew. Brett is a highly sought after consultant and mentor and is the founder of the performance coaching company, Bartholomew Strength. Brett, thank you so much for joining the show. I'm really honored and excited to have you here. I know you're probably super busy right now with everything going on with the book launch, which is doing absolutely phenomenal. But this is a really important topic and something that we really haven't talked about here on the show. So I'm really looking forward to this interview session. So as we kick things off, Brett, what does the audience need to know about you before we get into all of my questions?
I would say the most important thing as it pertains to the context that we're going to discuss is, you know, even though I got into the field of strength and conditioning, more and more I'm really understanding that what we do is really human performance, whether that's the podcasts and the information you're trying to share, the psychosocial domain, as I allude to in my book, or physiological principles of making people, their best selves, bigger, stronger, faster, leaner, whatever that means in the context of sport. You're really seeing a unique time in human performance, and hopefully I'm bringing a little bit more clarity from a space that isn't talked about much. So I would say that I started off as a simple strength coach, but more and more I'm trying to get into more aspects of human performance in totality.
Let me ask you this. So the book just came out. I believe it came out in March 8th, 2017. What's been surprising to you since the book came out?
Probably the breadth of responses that I've gotten. I wrote this book and tried to keep it self-published to keep its soul a little bit. A lot of strength coaches felt like we had a lot of things that we could turn to within training that were our own, but anything we wanted to go into in terms of business, communication, leadership, what have you, usually had to be things that we went outside. You know, the corporate CEO had written, and we learned whether it was Seven Habits of Highly Effective People or Dale Carnegie's work. It didn't really feel like there was anything that was from strength and conditioning coaches about this stuff that could then project outward. I didn't think many people outside of our core group would buy it because, you know, when you do turn down publishing opportunities that typically want to make it more of a ubiquitous feel, typically that's what happens. You funnel your scope a little bit. But ironically, it's done just the opposite, I think. And I'm grateful for this. Enough people have felt like it was the right topic at the right time. And it's had a fairly broad appeal. I mean, folks from Microsoft and Facebook have reached out recently, which was a tremendous surprise to me and honor. And so, yeah, I would just say the reception was not anticipated, but I'm very grateful for it.
So the book is titled Conscious Coaching, The Art and Science of Building Buy-In. And you talk about this in the book in the beginning that it's for the coach, but it's not just for the strength and conditioning coach. It actually goes to a much broader audience than that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's for teachers, guides, yeah, torchbearers, as Nancy Duarte would call them, of all kinds. So, you know, it's for anybody that's a guide in any profession, be that a consultant at McKinsey, yeah, right? Or yeah, be it, you know, somebody in human performance. So kind of broad spectrum.
What led you to write the book? What was the fire behind it?
Yeah. So as I alluded to a little bit earlier, I just don't think that there was something that really covered this topic. I think you get into sports psychology and it's kind of oftentimes warm, wishy-washy, repeat this mantra five times and think positive thoughts in your head kind of stuff. I think a lot of times people are a little bit, you know, hitch over the head with the palate kind of, the habit mantra as well. Like, right, hey, if you just do habits and you're productive and there's mindfulness, but the reality is there's a little bit more to that than the social science, right? There's everything, whether you want to call it seduction, manipulation, that touches on first impressions and how we get people, you know, to connect with us, to phrasing, how we choose certain words and terms in order to improve kind of conversational currency or fluency with people. That was a big piece. Now, the biggest part, and this is discussed in chapter two, I was hospitalized for about a year of my life. And during that period, I was around what were supposed to be the foremost in medical practitioners for this certain circumstance. And really what you kind of found was people that had a whole lot of letters behind their name, but had forgotten the human element of interaction and kind of behavior. And so I knew right when I got into coaching, it was important for me to know the technical, tactical aspects of it. But I also needed to know how to communicate with people from different backgrounds, whether socioeconomically or whether, you know, geographically or any other aspect of it.
What do you think was missing? Do you think it was just the kind of the bedside manner or the ability to connect? What was it that you saw being a problem?
I think it's just bias. I think people, yeah, by and large think they know what they know. And you see it, especially in people that have done a certain thing for a long time. And just because they have a title or they have a job that pays them well, or because they have people that have told them they're talented at what they do before, they start to kind of, you know, drink their own Kool-Aid a little bit. And I think they see things as they want to see them. You know, I think there's a certain aspect to where that can be true. We all have bias. We all have heuristics, as Daniel Kahneman in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, alludes to. And they're not always wrong, but sometimes people judge a little bit prematurely. And people in general want to conserve energy. And to go outside their bias and their scope of kind of heuristic, it takes work and that takes mental energy. And we know the amount of energy the brain consumes. So I think there's physiological reasons for it and psychological and sociological reasons for that.
How much research went into the writing of this book?
To quantify it, I mean, I would have to look and see how many articles were referenced. I know there was probably at least 20 more that my editor told me that I needed to can, because we really wanted to be the book. We wanted the book to be a combination of science and stories.
Yeah.
You know, you start getting a little too research heavy, which was a wormhole I started going down for a while, and you really start to alienate the audience. Conversely, if you don't, you know, back things up with research, then, you know, you're kind of just stating your opinion, aren't you? you know, and so, right. which is valuable. It's not invaluable.
Right.
It's not that it's not valuable, rather. It's just that you need to back some things up. So, I mean, enough that it took me 3 years, not full years, but I coach full time. So, you know, this book was written between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. in the morning, you know, when I did write, because the strength and conditioning coach, wow. as you likely know, right? Like your hours aren't awesome. In that time frame, I mean, you had the normal life stuff happen. I got married, I changed jobs, surgeries, family stuff, what have you. And then, I mean, I'm not a professional writer, right? So I never sat down. For me, there wasn't this process of sitting down every day with my coffee, finding clarity and writing. Right. Yeah. I can appreciate folks that do that, right. but my job full-time was coaching and managing a business. This was a secondary hobby, but yeah, enough that you go back and you debate what research you should go into. And then you also want to let these ideas slow cook a bit.
Sure.
You know, so not all research that I thought was a good idea at first stuck in the book.
Got it. Do you feel that there is a disconnect specifically between the athlete and the coach as far as communication?
No question. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, to expand on that, you're looking at a time where technology reigns supreme right now in high performance. You know, people are collecting data. There's all kinds of performance profiles being done on players and athletes. A lot of times they're distrustful, especially athletes within the NFL, which is my core demographic, as they believe this data is being used against them to show owners and general managers if they're not producing or if their body's not at this level that it should be or what have you. That may or may not be the case depending on the organization. But yeah, there's a lot of distrust now, especially in this social media self-promotional me now world, is higher than ever because everybody's got a game to play. Very Machiavellian culture that we live in now.
What's the single biggest thing you think we can do to improve that?
Understand your own communication style. I think a lot of times people project outward when they should look inward. And I don't mean, you know, Eastern philosophy, sit there and listen to the wind blow type stuff. I mean, just ask yourself tough questions. I think we're too busy criticizing, condemning, and complaining about others and not doing enough internal self-reflection. Oftentimes I get asked the question, hey, how do you deal with this type of athlete? And it's amazing the responses you get when you ask them, well, what have you done so far? Generally, you get a blank stare and, you know, you might see a little bit of drool form in the corner of the lip. And, you know, people just don't ask themselves the tough questions and, yeah. and aren't introspective enough by nature.
So you just said understand your own communication style. And in the book, as we just talked about before we started recording, I literally just got the book yesterday. I'm about 25 pages in, but I did skim through some other sections of the book as well. What was really interesting, well, several interesting things obviously in the book, but the tools of the trade that you talked about, and you talked about the online personality assessment tools. You named five tools. I've actually done three of the five that you've mentioned. Is there one out of those five that you have found the most success with?
No, I mean, and that's kind of what I go into in the book is I talk about the strengths and weaknesses of all of them. Okay. You know, you have a lot of those that are based off Jungian characteristics, which Professor Adam Grant, who has done a good amount of research on these personality profiles, says that the accuracy of many of those are somewhere in between a heart rate monitor and a horoscope, you know, but people will stick on these kind of things that are, you know, typecasted by big five personality traits. And they think that's, you know, boom, that's it. When in reality, a lot of them are forced choice question, which sometimes that's going to happen. You know, you're going to be able to create the perfect test for every domain is pretty, pretty difficult.
Right.
One that I like a lot, just based off the research, is the Hogan personality assessment.
Okay.
Because it goes into, and I talk about this more in the book, dark-sided leadership traits. So as opposed to just telling you about your strengths and what have you, it actually dives deep into what you do and how you revert into during times of chaos and what are kind of less desirable aspects about yourself that could be leveraged into positive aspects or non-positive aspects. Specifically, as the research alludes to, there's three traits, narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy, that typically people view as bad or read just dark traits. But the reality is some of the most effective presidents in our history have rated high in those aspects. They also look at corporate CEOs and leaders of all kinds of businesses that rank higher than average in traits of psychopathy. So many times people get attached to a word and what they're meaning. I mean, I say psychopath And immediately any listener may think Dexter. They may think Jeffrey Dahmer. They may think Ted Bundy. But that's not what psychopathy means. Psychopathy just means that these people respond a little bit differently to situations that involve chaos, risk, or fear. And we're all tuned in at different levels. It's like sliders on a mixing board, as researcher Kevin Dutton alludes to. Some people are tuned way far up in the psychopathy kind of scale where nothing registers. It's almost like their amygdala is dormant. Others, right, are hyper-tuned, right? They have too much empathy. And that's not a good thing either. So I talk about that, and then I divide different personalities not as a solution to the problem, but as something that adds to the conversation into different archetypes, characteristics of athletes that I see or have seen in over a decade of coaching.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the archetypes. Let me just follow up with the tools again. So just give people that aren't familiar with these tools, these five tools, an idea of what they are. Are they free tools? And is there one that you would recommend for maybe a coach or trainer that's listening?
Sure. I'd recommend they get familiar with all of them as much as possible. There is not one that I recommend. Okay. That was a big reason I wanted to put them in the book, is I wanted to let them know what's out there, the good, the bad, and the ugly about all of them. Okay. But some of them include the Clifton Strength Finders, which I think is phenomenal for its own reasons. I really enjoyed that one. You look at the DISC assessment, which is very popular. Most people, regardless of vocation, have heard of the DISC assessment. I was made to perform one in the sixth grade, which was interesting. You have your Myers-Briggs.
Right.
You have your Hogan assessments. Let's see. There's another one called the Insights Discovery, which is based off the Jungian characteristics as well. And now, I mean, shoot, somebody just told me about another one the other day. But, you know, there's almost a new one. And basically what these tools are is they help you find out what's influential about you. So a lot of times, even though this was not their initial purpose by the researchers, companies will ask people from these services to come in and they'll say, hey, here's our heavy hitters, our most effective employees. We'd like you to take them through these kind of personality assessments, what are called psychometric assessments. And we want to find what it is about them so we can extract it and then use it as hiring kind of cannon fodder for other folks. So, let's say that you're really strong, using the Strength Finders one as an example, at WU, which is an acronym they use for winning others over, right? You're just very good at speaking, influencing. You're an activator. You're somebody that's very good at taking an idea and bringing it into play. So my best friend, he works at Adidas Futures with their kind of innovation team, so to speak. He's a great guy, but he's also a little bit like C-3PO. The dude is always computing. And if you don't put somebody around him that can take one of his ideas and activate on them or make them actionable, this dude will just warp himself into hyperspace, kind of like a Gary Busey, so to speak. Like he'll just talk himself in circles. Right. So they'll extract certain characteristics and say, hey, these are either things about you that are influential, these are things that you tend to do, or these are things about you that are not so great, as in the Hogan personality. I guess if pressed a little harder to answer your question, Scott, I would recommend a combination of Strength Finders and Hogan assessments, just because I think that people do need to understand what dark traits they have. I do think people need to not just know what's great and warm and fuzzy about them. There's a lot of value in knowing what sucks about you. And this feeds into a part of the book, not to jump ahead, but I just say, rather than getting caught up on an assessment, Scott, I think there's three stages of internal identification that everybody have to go through. There's reflection, right? So question who you are. Why do you do what you do? Why is that important to you? Get down to the very construct. And don't allow yourself to say, oh, I do it to make a difference. That's very surface level. Okay. Like, what about that is important to you?
Right.
After that, there's inspection. So that's examining who you are. And this is just kind of that excavation. So take the insights from your reflection and examine them more closely, meaning, okay, why do you do what you do? Why is that important for you personally? Why is that important for you professionally? And even at a deeper level, where did those desires come from to be that great or to go in that direction? And then the final one is progression. And that one is owning who you are. So a lot of times we're taught to be something different than who we are, right? Like be more productive, be this. I mean, I'm sure you're riddled with it, right? Like every 5 seconds we get five tips to improve your morning routine.
Right.
And if I did everything that was out there, right, we'd wake up, we'd work out. And by the way, it would be like the best workout of our lives because we know everybody just wakes up in the morning ready to go. We'd eat the perfect breakfast. we'd read three research journals and maybe two books, and then we'd write, and then we'd go on, you know, like running our business and then making love to our wife and raising our kids perfectly.
Right.
Like, this is what your thoughts like happens. That's how it happens. Yeah. Like, yeah. Everybody has their own process. Sometimes there's some things that are toxic to what we do. Sometimes there's things that are great. I really believe that as long as you have a rhythm to your rhyme and a method to your madness, you'll be all right. You just need to be consistent and persistent with what that is.
Excellent. So I will share just a couple of very quick things about the tools, and then we'll move on. We'll talk about the archetypes. I've done StrengthsFinder twice in the last 14 years, and they changed a little bit. One thing that was consistent was really no surprise to me, which, and you can see behind me is the books, is a learner. You know, that was one of the strengths. I love to learn. I'm like ridiculously passionate about it. But I think that's a really valuable tool because, and I can't remember how many strengths there are total. I think it's 34,
if
I'm mistaken.
Yep.
And it shows you your top five. So I do like that tool. But the one that really sticks is Insight because it's the four colors. And out of doing those tools, just something so simple and that everybody seemed to identify with. So
the Insights discovery tool?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the biggest criticism with that, and it talks about in the book, is just kind of the research and the validity and everything behind kind of the Jungian theory of it doesn't really hold water for much, right? Mm-hmm. And they're almost kind of a little bit truism-like. We tend to see things, you answer questions almost based on the response you wish the real you would give.
That's
not always the case. And that's a harsh criticism a harsh but honest criticism of most of these is we feel this kind of social and societal pressure that even if we want to answer A, we should answer B, you know? And
I can see that. I know what you mean. Yes.
And that's why I recommend, I know it sounds odd, we're talking about this book, but I really do recommend most everybody reads Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. Just a very, very fascinating book. And it helps you kind of understand what's a little bit goofy about the way that you decide and kind of, it goes into just system one, right? And two, like, so we have our automatic and unconscious thought, kind of our fast thinking, and then slow thinking, the part of us that's deliberate and more conscious. And it just talks about how we make those choices based off system one and two. But really interesting stuff.
Let's move on to talk about the archetypes here. And I'm holding your book and, you know, there's many archetypes listed in the book. Give us an overview. What is that? How did you develop this concept and maybe an example of one?
Yeah. So the most kind of one thing writing's done for me, and I don't necessarily like writing, but it helps me consolidate my thoughts. So the most simply I can state what an archetype is a general example of something. So to relate it, right, on Facebook or social media, we know that there's somebody that will log on and they're always posting something political, right? That's the political guy. And then there's somebody that's always posting a picture of their kids, right? And like you may know, of course, like everybody loves their family, but every 5 seconds, it's like their kids.
Right.
And then there's somebody that always wants to post their food. So, you know, over my time working both on the team side of athletics and in the private sector, I've realized that there's general examples of athlete personas. So in the book, I list some such as the royal, who's going to be more of your entitled, kind of had his butt kissed, probably naturally talented, but hasn't benefited from the fact that a lot of people tell him that he's talented. You know, he's not always the most coachable because he thinks he or she, of course, this is male or female.
Right.
They think that they generally know how to do what they need to do and they've gotten there already. So, you know, and in the NFL, you'll get the royal type that will say, how much do you make again? Yeah, I think I make more than you. I'm okay. You'll have the Wolverine, which is a little bit more of an irascible, rogue, withdrawn persona. Somebody that may, you know, one that always comes to mind for me is I coached an athlete one time that saw his mother stabbed. And, you know, he came up from a pretty rough area of East St. Louis and good kid, but very much like the X-Men depiction of that character, you know, just didn't want to talk about things, kind of wanted to be left alone. He'd do everything that was asked, and you couldn't really coach him the same way as you could maybe the natural leader, which is another archetype. This is somebody who's a little bit more gregarious. They want to be on the front lines. They want to lead and unite everybody together. So, you know, it spans 15 different archetypes. Other ones include The skeptic, the name kind of tells you everything you need to know about that. Right. Somebody that, you know, may want help but is skeptical or is going to question every single thing you do. Usually needs a little bit more of that Simon Sinek approach of starting with why for you to win them over. There's the underdog, there's manipulators. So there's a wide range. And, you know, so to give a more classical example, in the book, I name the archetype and I make, listen, I as I say in the book, these names are contentious. People can call the, you know, I'm not trying to create my own scale here,
right?
People can call them whatever they want. This just happens to be what I named them. But, you know, let's say we're looking at the skeptic, for example. I'll give an overview so that you can make sense of them, who they are, and then I'll give strengths and weaknesses. As we know, one strength of being a skeptic is, well, you shouldn't believe everything you're told, right? Like most times you should leave with more questions than you do answers. But the downside of the skeptic is sometimes they are so rigid in the overall plasticity of their thinking, right? They have these kind of constructs. Maybe they don't trust easily. You know, their own heuristics and bias keep them from future growth. And even if it's an NFL veteran that's been in the league 8 years and is a three-time Pro Bowler, there's still things they can learn because that's great that you're a Pro Bowler. Have you won a Super Bowl yet? No. Okay. Why? You know, and dig and dig and dig. So these things help you kind of really understand what's at the core of what drives people essentially. Right. And drives are not motivation. Motivation and inspiration is kind of, it's not indelible. You and I can watch a YouTube video. We can get motivated and then we can fall asleep back on the couch. But a drive is something that's kind of, it is pervasive in our DNA. It is always going to compel us to do a certain thing. So in the book, I talk about the archetypes, how that coincides with drives, and how you can go about kind of navigating this constellation of emotional and psychological traits most people have to find out what drives them at the highest level.
How do you recommend the practical application of using the information on archetypes?
Yeah, well, I use it every day. So I think it depends if you're a strength coach or a personal trainer. I mean, you're going to have to sit there just like you look at what their body fat is, what their diet's like, what their sleep's like, what their training schedule's like. You know, you have to sit there and have a conversation with your athletes or your clients, however you want to term it. You have to make sure that you're actually researching and learning about their background and their history. You have to communicate openly. Research shows people will volunteer more information about themselves when we do so first. You know, and then I create personally, I have an Excel file where, you know, I write down facts about my athletes so that I can, you know, engage them better in conversation, keep them engaged when we do competitions and a variety of things. So I look at it as no different than any other KPI. And this book should guide you as to better communicate with these folks after you've identified them.
So without getting to this point in the book, without reading it myself yet, is it something that when you read about the technician, when you read about the royal, the soldier, that it's easily identifiable to the reader where it sticks with us that we can identify those
people? Oh, I mean, I think so. I mean, of course, listen, you're talking to, and I know you've written quite a bit, right? So anytime you ask somebody that's written something, I'm going to say I like to think I did my best, but of course we know when we go back and reread our work, we're often embarrassed and disappointed we weren't a little bit more clear. So I certainly think that I provided as much context there as possible to make it useful. And if I didn't, I brought in 15 other coaches and practitioners worldwide, ranging from guys that work in the NFL to special forces to different parts of the globe. We have a coach in there from Arsenal. We have a coach in there from Australia. And all of them take the information I kind of tee up with how to identify these archetypes, how to observe them and connect with them, and then how to apply it. They tell their story as to how they interacted with somebody like that in real time. Because I wanted this book not to only be rich in theory, but also application.
Got it. So the whole key to your system, your approach, is understanding yourself as a coach and then understanding the athlete and the different types.
Essentially, I mean, I stole my system from Sun Tzu, The Art of War, right? Like, know thyself, know thy enemy, a million battles fought, a million battles won. You know, in terms of getting to know people, and I talk about this in the book as well, I just kind of use a 3R approach: research, relate, and reframe. I'm going to ask more questions. I always want to seek to understand. After that, I want to be able to show them that I can relate to them. They need to feel comfortable around me, whether that's volunteering information, whether that's telling them a story, whether that's empathizing with something they did, whether that's building off of that and just letting them talk some more, whatever that is. And then reframing that is simply after you know who they are and what they want, now you can take what you need them to do and show them how that coincides. I try to keep things really simple. I don't need a 3, 6, 12, 8-step kind of program. I just think you need to seek to understand and then, you know, communicate clearly. And I think good things usually happen eventually.
What is the art of coaching? When you hear that phrase, the art of coaching, what does that mean to you? How do you define that?
The art of connecting. Simply put.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I think you just need to know how to communicate and connect with others.
With communication, and again, I apologize if this is covered in the book or if it's not, I'm not sure, but communicating the internal and external cues, for example, is that part, how important is that in the communication style for a coach and athlete?
Yeah, you're referring to the research, like Gabrielle Wolf's research?
Yes, yep.
Yeah, yes. So that is actually what I obtained my master's degree in, was attentional focus. Okay. So myself and Jared Porter, who is Dr. Gabrielle Wolf's, one of her understudies at Southern Illinois University is where he's at. And you can find that online if anybody's interested in nerding out. If you just type in my name and attentional focus, it'll come up. But talking in color, essentially, as I put it, is really important. You know, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. And, you know, for any listeners not familiar, an external focus based cue is something that focuses more on the outcome of the movement. So, for example, if we're doing a broad jump, and you know, there's a wall at the end of the room, instead of them saying, hey, you know, extend through the ankles, knees, and hips, which is more internal focused on body position, you'd say, try to jump to the end of the room, try to jump to that wall. Something that even if it is impossible, it gives them something to focus on that's outside of themselves. And the idea as to why most of the research says that is effective, and there is a wealth of information that says that's effective, although my research study shows that it was not in that particular, in the context that we did, is based on what's called the constrained action hypothesis. So if you give somebody an internal cue focusing on body position or an advanced maneuver, they tend to internalize, much like, when you were 18 and you saw a pretty girl at the bar. You know, you probably would have gotten farther just going up and saying hi, but you're sitting there wondering what's the best pickup line. So when you focus too much internally, it constrains your natural abilities, however that's defined within the context of that situation. And so really, really interesting research. The book does touch on that,
okay.
Although we didn't want to go too far down that avenue, as that would have opened up a whole nother lion's gate of information that probably would have overwhelmed some folks. But absolutely, talking in color and being externally focused is critical.
Okay.
Great question on your side, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
You got me thinking on a lot of these.
I wasn't sure how much you went into that in the book, so.
Yeah, we try to do enough to be dangerous. Again, you know, it's interesting, like writing. I wanted to write more, but, you know, your editor kind of, you have to trust them in the process of knowing when's too much and you know, is there a second book and what have you. So
in the very beginning, and I literally just read some of this material.
No problem,
this
no
morning.
Worries.
Okay. But you talked about coaches seeking the next course, learning experience, learning about movement screens and preventing injury. But in your opinion, I mean, are we missing what's most important?
I don't know if I'm not saying this stuff is most important. I do think that you have to know the X's and O's of what we do.
Okay.
You know, physiology, biomechanics, no question. I mean, that's something I say in the beginning of the book, is this isn't suggesting the art of coaching supersedes the science. This is saying that a conscious coach, somebody that's aware of all avenues, because that's what the term insinuates, that's what it was created for, understands the necessary balance. And I simply make the case in the book that you need to be well-rounded. I don't think that there's much stuff on this, on the art of coaching piece. Anything that is out there is just kind of soft science related, not really presenting it as, I think, something that's backed in the research. But the reality is the social science have just as much, if not far more, research to back them than the physiological based sciences. So I don't think we're missing the most important thing. I think that we're missing a critical piece of the puzzle.
Got it. And that's what you hope that this book will kind of fill the gap and address.
Yeah, I don't think it's a one answer. Like I said, you know, I'm not narcissistic enough to think that I wrote the end all be all text on it, but hopefully it takes a conversation in a productive direction.
If you had to say maybe the three most important distinctions or qualities of a great coach, what are those three qualities when I ask you that question?
Yeah, I think one, a great coach has to not be afraid to take risks. I think you need to be able to set your ego and bias aside and always be willing to think that there's something else out there, or that you need to know when to go with the research, when to deviate from it a little bit. I think you have to take risks for those reasons, but also you have to take risks in your career, because I think experience is an elusive term. I think sometimes people have 25 years experience in a field, and that basically means they've done the same program, they flipped the same light switch. I don't think that experience equates to mastery. I think that, you know, exposure and experience together do. I think you have to expose yourself to dense and diverse situations, you know, coach in a variety of domains and a variety of clients. It's easy to feel like you're world-class at something if you stick within your safety zone. So I think risk is critically important. I think compassion more so than empathy. Empathy is kind of, I feel what you feel, whereas compassion is, I understand what you feel. And I think it's dangerous, you know, if you try to have too much empathy, it can make you a soft leader, when, you know, compassion makes you a bit more utilitarianism in your approach, meaning that you kind of know which dimmer switch to flip on, you know, which side of yourself you need to be at what time. And then authenticity. I think authenticity is the crux of any consistent world-class high-level performer. If you're not consistent in what you do in your approach, nobody's going to know what to expect, and certainly nobody's going to trust you.
And on the flip side of that, when you think about a bad coach, I'm sure there's probably been coaches that you've worked with that are not ideal. And sure. What would be something to avoid? I mean, is there something when you think about that person, that coach, what is something that you said, that's not going to be me and how I approach it?
Hubris and insecurity.
Okay.
So excessive pride and insecurity. And, you know, I've been that coach, you know, early on in my career. Like I used to think, you know, like, for example, anybody that did social media or podcasts or yada, yada, yada was, you know, a sellout or somebody that wasn't really coaching. I thought that because some of the coaches that I was around thought that. So, you know, as a young coach, I'm like, yeah, you know, screw anybody online, you know. And then eventually I started realizing, well, if I'm sitting here throwing rocks and I'm not doing anything to improve it, what good am I? You know, I think I also used to think that, you know, trying to prove how smart I was to athletes was a great way to get their trust.
Yeah.
A lot of that came from just me being in uncommon circumstances at 24 or 25. I was thrown in front of some pro athletes or high level military operators. And so I just wanted them to feel like they were in competent hands. In reality, I just came off like a jerk. So hubris, which means excessive pride, as you know, and then insecurity are big pieces. I also talk about in the book, without giving too much of it away, what I call the four horsemen syndrome of a bad coach. But I'll let the readers kind of dive into that a little bit more.
Okay, I haven't seen that. So
yeah, it's in chapter four. It's in the second to last chapter.
Brett, what makes you successful today? I mean, if you had to say, you talk about how you've evolved as a coach. You know, what's the number one thing that makes you successful today? And when did that happen? When did that specific shift happen for you?
First, I think if you took a poll, you'd probably be hard pressed to find, it depends on people's definition of success.
Okay.
I don't really view myself as successful. I hope I'm effective.
Yeah.
And I think just consistency, persistence, and the desire to legitimately do something that matters and helps people. You know, and that may sound trite, but at the end of the day, you have to have some focus. Now, where that chip on my shoulder came from is I didn't really have a classic mentor. I didn't have anybody that really invested in, you know, helping me become X. I had a lot of people actually that were the opposite. When I left collegiate athletics, I had a coach that told me, you know, if you make this move into the private sector, I promise you, you'll never get back into team sport, almost as if it was a threat. You know, I've had people that told me I was self-centered for not taking a job in the NFL when it was offered because they feel like that would have been anybody's dream job. Yeah. I've had people that tell me the business that I'm about to open here in a few months is going to fail. So, you know, I think that you have to let not pride guide you, but a desire to accomplish a certain mission. My mission is to arm people with knowledge that I wish I would have had when I first came out, and create kind of a return back to this apprentice-centered society as opposed to a me-now microwave culture that we have now. I think, and finally, just to be honest with you, and I don't mean to be long-winded, Scott.
Yeah, no.
Like, I want to bring our profession into the 21st century and show strength coaches specifically that you don't need to just die working in the trenches, coaching 8 groups a day, yada, 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 to be successful. That even though balance, life balance may not really exist, I think it's more of a seasonal thing than it is a 50-50 piece, that you can actually go out there and have an underground mindset, but have a mainstream influence. And those are things that I'd like to achieve, because I just think people get in our field, whether it's personal training or whether it's strength and conditioning or human performance, anything that deals with people and this, I think there's a lot of people that are burning out. I think there's a lot of unhealthy coaches. I think there's a lot of people that have their lives are falling apart and they're really good at taking care of other people, but not themselves.
So if you could change one thing, and maybe you just said that, would that be the thing that you'd like to change in the industry, maybe specific for strength coaches?
Yeah, I think just more people bridging the gap between everything that comprises performance, whether that's your life outside of your work inside of work, being known as a great practitioner, entrepreneur, and influencer. It's why I'm naming the company, you know, right now, it's just my LLC. Bartholomew Strength was a personal webpage.
Yeah.
A guy out in Cedar Rapids, Iowa owned BrettBartholomew.com. So I had to come up with something else, and that was Bartholomew Strength. But okay. The company that we're transitioning it to is The Bridge. And that's why I'm naming it that, is I feel like there needs to be more people focused on bridging gaps as opposed to always competing and trying to tear each other down and, you know, undercut each other and just get involved in kind of nonsense that isn't surrounding making the field better.
How do you operate today, Brett, as far as like a consultant, speaker? You do a lot of different things, as I understand it. So maybe, do you want to talk about that for a few minutes?
Sure. Well, right now, I don't know when this will be aired, but it's June 2017, right, as you and I are chatting. I'm in a transition. So I just moved out from LA. Usually, I'm a full-time coach, so 3/4 of my day is spent coaching, and the latter fourth of the day just answering email, this, that, whatever, maybe speaking at some clinics. Within the past 2.5 years after I left Exos, formerly Athletes Performance, I was able to do some more consulting and speaking. While we worked there, that wasn't the case. You could speak for Exos, but you couldn't promote it, promulgate it, or expand upon it really in any way, unless that was your job to do so. That was their rules, and I respected their rules because they gave me a job and they gave me a lot of opportunities, right? But now that I'm on my own, I'm able to do a bit more. So I work for certain government entities in a consulting capacity. I work with a number of teams or organizations in a consulting capacity. Some of them more in the psychological domain, discussing things with conscious coaching. Others just as a devil's advocate, looking at programming and talking shop and kind of serving as an ear outside of their organization that can guide them. But once the facility's open, I'll be back to full-time kind of coaching as well as, so I'm a coach, consultant, and entrepreneur, probably the three spectrums I inherit. Right now, my work coaching-wise is mainly done with NFL, right this time of year, off-season free agents, people looking to get re-signed, mixed martial arts fighters, and then the occasional executive athlete as well.
And where do you live right now, Brett?
Atlanta, Georgia, and that's Atlanta. Where we're opening okay. our facility out here. In the heart of Atlanta.
Got it. What's the, for coaches, trainers that are listening, what's something that you wish you knew when you were getting started? You talked about maybe the mistakes you made. What's something that you could share?
Anything that I wish I knew is just more around the ins and outs of business.
Okay.
You know, you don't get what you deserve in life. You get what you negotiate. And I think, you know, that's why one of my earliest favorite books was Robert Greene's The 48 Laws of Power. The book was essentially written by Robert Greene to tell people the multitude of ways they can be taken advantage of and cheated out of things in life. It's a very dark book if you don't read it correctly. A lot of people mistakenly say it's, hey, you're looking out for number one. That's not the way it's written. He himself was an individual that had a lot of circumstances where he was outsmarted, outwitted, taken advantage of, what have you. And he studies classical history. whether that's military strategy or executive kind of stuff done in the corporate world, and just says, hey, these things are bound to get the best of you if you don't pay attention. I think coaching wise, there's not much, you know, like I think people a lot of times want something that, you know, oh, I wish I would have known this about designing programs, right? Like, right. But that's out there, right? Yeah, like there was never a time where I didn't know a squat was important. Yeah. There was never a time that I didn't know that people should focus on good technique. So I know there's this pervasive search for the holy grail of training advice. I think the best advice people can get is before you make any person, athlete, client, whatever, do it, make sure you're training yourself. I think more people, if they are just smart about doing their due diligence with the research and then using themselves as a lab rat, would figure out a lot of their own issues. And then just the typical less is more, you know, people just, I don't think invest at the highest level 80-20 capacity of training. It's a lot of filler.
Do you mind if I ask you about your training specifically? Like, so no. What do you do personally? What tools do you like? How do you approach training yourself?
Yeah. So there's three main principles that I abide by. One, multi-joint movements. So your squats, your pull-ups, your rows, your lunges, your presses, what have you. Multi-planar movements. That means, you know, I try to do rotational work in the frontal plane, whether that's as simple as a lateral lunge or a rotational med ball slam, or it's more complex, doing a heavy contrast set, one-arm dumbbell bench press with heavy bag strikes, left or right arm. I have a boxing background. So, you know, okay. That's that. And then finally, you know, things have to be ground-based. You know, I'm not a big machine guy. It doesn't mean I don't think they're effective at all. It just means, you know, I generally perform in favor, you know, the Olympic lifts or just other movements where my feet are on the ground, you know, with the exception of, you know, again, if I have military guys that I'm working with that, you know, have amputations or what have you, we'll use machines. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't use a lat pull down. It doesn't mean that I mean, your feet are on the ground there as well. But as long as it's ground-based, multi-joint, multi-planar, it makes it in my playbook.
When do you train, if you don't mind me asking that question? So with everything that you have going on, how do you fit that into your schedule?
Yeah, either really late at night, so 10 p.m. or after. I'm a night owl. Or in this example, you know, it's what is it? It's you and I are talking and it's 5:46 Eastern Standard Time. I'll train right after this. So it's highly variable. Right now I'm traveling a ton. When the facility opens and day to day, I'm in my normal kind of coaching routine. I try to fit it in sometimes between 10 and 3. That just tends to be when my kind of circadian rhythms are rolling, but very often that doesn't happen. So it's usually late afternoon, early evening or late at night.
Got it.
Not a big morning guy unless I'm boxing or just doing ESD. You know, rolling out of bed at 5 a.m. I don't really feel up to like I must be getting old. But power cleans at 5 a.m. don't feel good on your body.
Right. I did that for a while. Actually, it's been probably 2 years ago now, but I was doing that for probably 2 years. I trained at like 5, 6 in the morning and my strength levels weren't there. I actually felt great during the rest of the day.
Yeah.
But I never had the strength early in the morning that I had later in the day.
So. And I find the same thing. I find that if you're just general fitness guy and you're doing just, you know, basic stuff, no question, you can get that done. If you're a lawyer on Fifth Ave and you just kind of want to make sure you fit in your suit. But if you like want to strength train, God bless anybody that trains really, really heavy and really intensely at 5 a.m. because it's just not enough calories in my body yet. And, you know, I think even neuromuscularly, you know, I'm not firing on all synapses there.
So you've actually done a lot of podcast interviews so far. Is there a big question, maybe a burning question that no one has asked you yet?
Well, see, you've done a really good job of it. I think that usually, you know, I had gotten a really good, I read a book called Power Questions, right? And I can't remember the author, so forgive me. But one of the questions I took away from it is, you know, what's one thing that people should be asking you but aren't? And I loved that because I'd always go to these clinics and they'd do round tables. And, you know, I felt like people would ask questions as a means of confirmation bias.
Right.
You know, they'd almost kind of lead the presenter into something they already knew. And then I remember the first time I asked that to somebody, I'm like, hey, what's something people should be asking you but aren't? Because I know for a fact, a lot of these presenters leave and they're like, you know, they have reactions about the audience. They'll say, hey, you know, even if you do like, you know, I did an Instagram live thing the other day because I've tried being more active on that.
Right.
And I got some questions that remind me just how much we seem to be failing fellow coaches. Because some of these questions were really green questions. And that doesn't mean they're bad. They're awesome. But if what we were doing worked, meaning right now we have the NSCA pumping out information, we have other organizations. If this was working, people wouldn't have these questions. Like, you're getting questions like, hey, are squats bad for you? You know, like, I don't even think some people know how to ask questions. So, and again, that's not me making fun of them.
Right.
That's me saying we're not teaching people how to ask the right questions. And again, I've been guilty. So I would say that's a big piece. And as much as you're not going to like this answer, the answer was yes. And it's everything I put in the book, you know, but it just really was right then. I think by and large, people would ask me questions about speed, power, strength, and agility. But when I asked my NFL athletes, why do you come to me?
Yeah.
Why do you come here? Not one of them said, Brett, you know what? I love when you do cluster back squats. You know, it was always, hey man, you just relate this stuff. Like, you help me understand how it's making me better for things that I care about. And that was a big part of the book.
So it is interesting because you mentioned somewhere in there that there's a question like, what's the one thing? And that's a question I ask a lot about different. I use it in different context. And one of the questions I feel like I have to ask you right now is, what is the one thing that you want the reader to take away from your book?
Yeah, that performance is deeper than data, that performance is that people aren't Toyota Camrys, and that research is so, so, so critically important. But if you don't expand your research lens beyond that of physiological, you know, the physiological base, whether that's biomechanics, hormonal adaptations, you know, what have you, you will never be a real coach because you're dealing with people, and people are messy and they're chaotic and, you know, they have agendas of their own. You know, it's funny to that point, the social media medium I'm most active on now is Instagram.
Yeah.
And I like Instagram because every day you can kind of put a mini presentation together,
right,
meaning it's one image that drives home a salient point. And then you can put a caption that's longer than Twitter, but just short enough to expand the conversation. Yes. You're not trying to answer everybody's questions. You're just trying to carry the conversation. And so I try to put a lot of that stuff on Instagram. Like, what is one thing I think people are missing? What's one book you could read that will help with this and those kinds of pieces? So, I just think it's deeper than data. You got to study people too.
Excellent. I'm a big fan of Instagram, by the way. I think it's a great tool for reasons you just mentioned.
Actually, I used to hate it. I used to think, no chance I'll ever get on it. I can't believe I'm even on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
And now I almost despise Twitter just because of the brevity.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so good for our field. It's better if you're a writer, I think. Like, writers can share their articles and what have you on it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's good for politicians. It's supposed to be a joke, Scott. And then, you know, Facebook, I think, is just, Facebook has turned into a marshland. So, you know, Instagram, I think, is a really good tool.
Yeah. All right. So just a couple more quick questions and we'll wrap this up. Again, the main place to find you and connect is BartholomewStrength.com.
Correct.
And it sounds like Instagram is a great place to find you as well.
Yep.
You've mentioned a lot of books in this interview, and this is a standard question I ask every interview is, what is there, and you probably mentioned this already, but is there a book that has impacted you the most or that you recommend the most to others?
Every single book written by Robert Greene.
Really?
Mastery, okay. The 48 Laws of Power, The 50th Law,
wow.
The Art of Seduction, The Laws of War, okay. Everything that you can read by Robert Greene. And again, you don't have to agree with me, but just from the pragmatism involved with his writing and the amount of research, I think it's tremendous. Instagram, if you follow me at, it's just coach_BrettB with 2 T's. I list books. If you just scroll back through my Instagram feed, you'll find books that I list on training, coaching, and just general life stuff as well. So if you want more on there.
Quick follow-up, if you don't mind, but how do you recommend reading? So any reading strategies for coaches that are busy? You know, I mean, they don't have the time to read. What's your secret to that?
I just think, you know, it's there's a couple kind of tips. One, invest in Audible. You know, when you're in your car, when you're on the plane, you know, what have you, you can always listen to books. So I use that, and then it allows me to take notes. And then, I mean, I think people think that you have to read like a book a week, read a page a night. If you're not reading anything now, read 2 pages a day,
yeah.
You know, like try to read 5 pages a week. I think just people need to start smaller and digest it. I've been reading the same book right now. It usually doesn't take me this long. Because I always get distracted and read other things. This book, it's taken me like 3 months to read. So I think people need to just quit putting timetables on stuff. Stay consistent and chip away is probably the advice. Chip away.
I'm going to share one thing that I've said. It's probably been a while since I've mentioned it here on the show, but read 10 minutes a day. Everybody has 10 minutes that they can fit into a day. And what happens is when you do that, it usually turns out to be 30 minutes or more time because you're going to be involved in the material that you read. So
no question.
If everybody can commit to just 10 minutes a day, it works.
Yep.
And it's very simple. So the final question, and by the way, thank you so much. This has been really fantastic.
My pleasure.
What's the number one takeaway action for the audience after hearing our interview session today?
If you can't explain it to a 6-year-old, you don't need to understand it well enough yourself. Old timeless quote by Albert Einstein. I think people are far much too often in love with their own voice. And I don't think they're chasing wisdom as much as they're chasing information. And I think more people could just really benefit from clarity of thought and doing some soul searching. And I don't know, maybe perhaps even putting your own stuff out there a little bit more. I think that risk and that vulnerability really helps provide clarity.
Yeah. Excellent. Great advice. Love it. Brett, thank you so much, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Scott. Yeah, thanks, man.
Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed that session with Brett Bartholomew as much as I did and got a lot of value out of it. Be sure to check out Brett's book, which is titled Conscious Coaching, and it looks to have a lot of great information and practical applications in this book as well. I am a couple chapters into this book right now, and I will be sure to come back and let you know what I think. Once I have read this book through, I should be done in the next couple of days or within a week. And it looks really, really breakthrough. So check it out if you haven't already. Thank you for joining me this week. Once again, be sure to go to ardellatraining.com/join to get some cool free training resources. And stay tuned for some new things coming your way as well. So that's a wrap for episode 212. I will see you next week on the show with another great interview session coming your way. Thanks, guys, and we'll talk again soon. Take care.